Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
I begin today by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land I'm on, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present, and I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening in. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Flux, and I'll be moderating Left Behind, the discussion with debut authors Sophie Overit and Emily Spurr. Sophie Overit is the author of The Rabbits, a haunting story with touches of magical realism, exploring the aftermath of a family grieving the disappearance of a son. Emily Spurr is the author of A Million Things, the story of Ray, a 10-year-old girl left to fend for herself in her mother's absence. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So I was struck by how many parallels there were between both of your works. They're so different, and yet there's so many commonalities to them. So I wanted to start with the biggest one. With both books centering around a disappearance, what drew you both to absences? How about we start with you, Emily?
I love that question. And I'm never really sure. I'm not sure that it was really absences that drew me to it. But then maybe it was. The idea for the story for me very much centered, came to me about Ray. And it was very much her being alone. So I suppose it is that negative space really that drew me to the story. You know, we're human creatures, aren't we? And we're social creatures, and we crave connection, and being alone is quite painful, almost physically painful, I think, loneliness is. And I suppose that's really what I was playing with. And you can't have that loneliness without the accompanying absence. And I've thought a lot about it, you know, since I wrote the book, why I went down that path and why I explored that. And I think it does. It comes back to human vulnerability and that searing pain of loneliness. And the best way for me to explore that was with absence, I think.
Yeah, amazing. I'm very similar, I think, to you in the sense of that kind of negative space and about what absence kind of tells us, I guess, about the characters who are left there. I tend to call them collateral damage narratives, which is something that I really love, and I'm really drawn to seeing what happens when to the people who, I guess, aren't, that shouldn't be the protagonist of the story. I mean, because in The Rabbits in particular, I mean, Charlie should be, in theory, the protagonist of this story. But I'm more interested in kind of what happens to all the characters around that. So again, yeah, it comes back to that negative space thing, I think, is really compelling and something that I'm drawn to as a writer and as a reader.
I really love that they shouldn't be the protagonist of the story. I hadn't even considered that. Yeah. That's like a lightning bolt moment. It's like, really, it's true, isn't it? Mm. You know, Charlie's like the superhero, I suppose, and Ray's mum's the one with the dramatic story, and yet it's not about them. And I think there is something in that, isn't it, in being drawn to the peripheral stories. And I think in the peripheral stories is where the magic happens in many ways. It's the everyday lives, I think, that are really quite extraordinary.
You tackle the absences in quite different ways, because in your story, Emily, the absence is there from the beginning. Like, Ray's mother is gone, and we slowly sort of learn what her life was like with her dotted throughout the book. Whereas for you, Sophie, we start off not with Charlie there, and then he goes away. So, I mean, why did you decide to approach them in those two different ways? As in, like, not that you were writing them together and then we're like, okay, we're going off in two different directions, but...
It should be fun. I suppose for me, and I, you know, the idea for this book came years and years ago for me. And when I started it, I spoke to a lot of people about it, and I quickly learned that that wasn't helpful for me. And some of the advice that I got from, and I don't mean it like it was bad advice, it was from people who really know what they're talking about. There was this idea that to really feel the absence of Ray's mum, we had to see her before she went and get an idea of their life before she went. And in my gut, that was never the way this story should be told. For me, it's because the story is very much about Ray, and it's centered on Ray, but also it's centered on loss, and it's centered on the missing person. And I wanted the reader, I wanted the experience of the story to be about getting to know that person through Ray. I didn't want the reader to have a relationship with Ray's mum that didn't include Ray. Ray's narrating the story. In fact, she's actually narrating the story to her absent mother. I didn't want her to have a presence beyond that, because in my mind, the central person, the collateral damage, as you said, Sophie, is very much it's Ray. So that was a really deliberate decision on my part. And it was a decision that kind of went against a lot of early advice I received, but it was the only way I could make the story work for me. So that's why I left her out. And because I wanted, as I said, I really wanted the reader's experience to be getting to know her mum through Ray. And that's, you know, the good and the bad, you know, and the really ugly, because love is complicated, and a child's love with their parents is complicated. And I wanted that to be seen through the prism of her thoughts.
And Sophie, you start off with a different disappearance, actually, with Bo, the sister of Delia, who's one of the key characters as well. So you do start with one absence and then you add on another one. So can you tell me a bit about your idea behind that?
The rabbits is kind of a funny one because it's something that went through quite a few different iterations. Like the original, the very first draft of it was actually a group of friends where someone went missing. And I kind of was actually a group of Charlie's friends. So it was a bit more YA skewed. It was a bit more of a, I think a bit more fantastical than what it ended up being. And I've kind of through that process realized that I was a lot more interested in the relationship between Charlie's family members than I was in writing his group of friends who aren't even in the book at all anymore. And kind of as it was through that process that I kind of was intrigued by this idea that disappearance is something that I think has generational impacts, even in reality, where people kind of, when you remove someone from a generation in a family, that disappearance is often felt in many, many ways. And I was interested in exploring what that looked like, if it was a literal disappearance, and if that kind of, if it resurfaced as something that just happened within a family, within different generations, and it had that tap-on effect. So kind of starting with Bo, with Delia's sister, and looking at the ways that the family just didn't deal with it. Just didn't address it really, and about how much that kind of fractured that generation, and about how through Charlie's disappearance, the family was kind of able to restitch itself back together. And I think that it was, like, I love the way you start A Million Things, and about how I loved it in the context too, where it feels starting with Ray. Just with Ray, I think really just emphasizes her isolation. And because that's something, you know, with the way she kind of sparks off in these different relationships are so much an effect of her mother's disappearance. Whereas the rabbits is kind of the opposite in a lot of ways, because it's very much more about the family kind of coming together in the wake of Charlie's disappearance. So I think it makes for an interesting juxtaposition there, I think, in how disappearances can impact so differently and create such different stories.
So actually going on from that point, like, because the disappearances and absences happen quite early or at the beginning of both your stories, the rest of the books are kind of about tracking the fallout and the evolution of the response to the absence. So can you talk a bit about how you approached seeing how a family or an individual would respond to someone suddenly being gone?
I think exploring the different ways that people handle something like that was something that was really appealing to me as well. And in particular, kind of a character like Delia, who's already gone through it with her sister, and then having it happen with her son, and just knowing that there's nothing worse than just being at home and waiting. So really trying to go on with her life while, you know, while her other son tries to seek him out, and her daughter really just tries to escape the entire situation altogether. And about how that kind of grows and changes throughout the story was really interesting, I think, to explore. I was actually really worried that people wouldn't like Delia at all. I was very surprised when people kind of really responded really well to her as a character. And about kind of her going back to work quite quickly was something I was a bit nervous about. But I think a lot of people, it resonated with a lot of people though too, because it's this sort of thing like, well, like I just said, there's nothing worse than just sitting there and waiting when you don't know what the answer's going to be. And so to kind of explore how Delia's relationship with work and with art generally evolved as she kind of tried to find her own way to navigate this disappearance. Yeah, it was something that was really interesting to me to explore generally.
I can't believe you people wouldn't like her.
Yeah. It's hard to know.
Yeah, true. Oh, she's one of my favourite characters. I adore her. How did I develop Ray's change? I suppose I'm a bit of a method writer, so I kind of climb into her head. You know, if I'm writing a scene, I sit down and I close my eyes and I try and feel what she's feeling and where is it in my body and what's going on. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And I suppose the novel really starts, it's she's clearly in shock and on autopilot, a bit like Delia, I suppose, in that sense. Delia needs to do something. She needs to go to work. With Ray, she just, you know, does the things that she does, you know, when her mum has been absent before, which is, you know, she gets ready to go to school and she looks after the dog and she makes sure that everything's running as it should be and everything from the outside looks really normal. But obviously this time isn't normal. You know, as time goes on, she's forced to find a new way of dealing with it and dealing with what she knows has happened. And I suppose that's where she's forced to be a little bit vulnerable to other people, which is something that she has never, has grown up. And I suppose it's that intergenerational thing again, you know, the parallel with the rabbits is that she has grown up to see vulnerability as dangerous. And now she finds herself in a situation where she's kind of having to face that vulnerability and accept it. And that's quite a challenge. So she's dealing with the pain of loss, but she's also dealing with the uncertainty of life and how long can she keep this facade going? You know, when is she going to be rumbled? She really does need, even though she won't admit it, she really does need some care in her life from the outside, and which she gets in the form of Letty. But that's a threat as well, because what happens if Letty finds out what's going on? Then everything's going to be burst open. So I had sort of a lot of layers to deal with there. So I had, you know, the grief and the trauma of what had happened. But then I also had the fear of being uncovered, the absolute fury. I think that's part of grief too, is that roiling anger that she was dealing with as well. And plus, you know, being 10 and having to work out, you know, how to pay the bills and, you know, how to keep everything going, you know, keep those wheels turning so that it looks like from the outside it's a normal car. I mean, the wheels aren't falling off, the engine's going, everything's fine. So I suppose that gave me a lot to play with in terms of her emotions and how they changed, because there was a lot going on. And I suppose in the same way that Delia used, you know, her art and her affair and all the you know, emotional excitement that goes along with that as a way of distracting herself, so too Ray had all these adult things that she had to cope with, which focused attention away from the thing that she can't face. Yeah, so I suppose sort of layering all of those on was how I built the picture of how what she was going through changed.
By having a disappearance at the centre of each book, it allows you to put the relationships in your stories under a microscope, because it is such an extreme situation that your characters find themselves in, so it pushes things to their limits. I was struck by how important mother-daughter relationships in particular were to both your stories, and both across the generations as well. Like, it wasn't just one mother-daughter relationship in each of your books. So can you talk a bit about this and why mother-daughter relationships in particular? Sophie, should we start with you?
Mother-daughter relationships, just something I'm really drawn to and I feel very compelled by. I'm very lucky. I've got a very good relationship with my mum. But in particular, you know, like a lot of my friends haven't, a lot of people I've had relationships with haven't had that good relationship. And in particular, my mum's relationship with her mum was good, but also had a lot of baggage, for want of a better phrase. And I think mother-child relationships, really some of the most important relationships in our lives. They're so formative in a way that I don't think many other relationships are. And I think they also hold a lot of generational trauma. I think the way our mothers are shaped by their mothers is something that is passed down generationally. And I was really interested in the way Delia and her mother Rosie's relationship, which had fractured after Beau's disappearance, had an impact on the way that Delia related to her own daughter, and about kind of the challenges that come along with something like that, where you have internalized, I think, a lot of pain and grief that doesn't really have an outlet, and how that, I think, comes out in relationships between women generally, not even just mothers and daughters, in ways that it doesn't necessarily in relationships between men and women or men and men. Although I do think a lot of men as well kind of have that same sort of thing. A lot of fathers and sons, particularly veterans and their sons, I think we see that a lot. So yeah, I was just interested in seeing the ways that I could capture that and explore it, and having that kind of manifest both through Bo's disappearance and then through Charlie's disappearance felt just like a really nice way to get into that.
The introduction to Rosie I found particularly striking, like when you first see their relationship and where it's at now, it's going to stick with me for a long time.
Yeah, it was beautiful. That was another thing that really struck me when I was reading, was the similarities there, and you know, between the rabbits and a million things, because certainly, obviously, you know, Ray's relationship with her mother, she's obviously her daughter and is looked after, but in many ways she's her mother's mother as well, and is forced to look after her and be a grown up in ways that, you know, most children aren't. Obviously, there's a, you know, proportion of kids out there that do deal with this sort of thing, which is, you know, one of the reasons I wrote about it. But also to later in the novel, when we meet Noni, who's Ray's grandmother, who Ray was unaware even existed, and we see that there's a breakdown between Ray's mum and her grandmother, which is, you know, why there's no relationship there. So I suppose in that sense I was in the same way, I was dealing with that intergenerational breakdown, and how when a relationship goes wrong in a family, the repercussions are much wider than the perhaps if it's just the two people that it's concerning, and it does go down generations. And I suppose that mother-daughter thing's a bit of a theme in my book. And also, you know, you've got Letty, who also lost a child. I don't know that it was deliberate. I think it's subconscious. I like to put out there that I also have a wonderful relationship with my mum. We're very, very close. And I mean, certainly there was a time in our lives where it was a very difficult relationship. But that was something that we both deliberately and consciously made the choice to work through, and we did, and we reap the benefits for that every day. Perhaps A Million Things is a tale of what happens when people don't have that option, and when things break down and are unable to be put back together. Like, the idea for this story came about because during my late teens, most of my 20s, I was quite unwell. I had significant mental health issues, and I'm well now and have been for years and years and years. But I wondered what would have happened if I'd had a child in all that trauma, you know, which could easily have happened, and what that would have been to them and how they would have survived. So I suppose that idea of intergenerational impact was always there and was probably the seed of the story, because certainly that's where the idea of Ray came from, was, you know, surviving that relationship when it doesn't work.
We've talked a little bit about this already, but like, there is a key disappearance at the center of each book, but there are other sort of disappearance and losses in both novels that are present. Can you tell me a bit more about these and how they fit into the bigger conversation? So for example, Sophie, like, there's the absence of the father in the rabbit story. Like, he's around, but he's not around. And there's also the grandmother and how she's present, but she's not what she used to be. So can you tell me a bit about like the other losses and the other absences in your book?
I was actually just loving what you just said, Emily, about kind of choosing to make relationships work. And I think that was something that I really did have in the back of my head when I was writing this as well, which was about the fact that love really half the time is a choice that people make, and making relationships better is a choice. And there's also that kind of whole thing, isn't there, about how not making a choice is still making a choice. That was something I just found really, I always find really interesting, and I think is something that, yeah, I think about a lot. And I think about a lot in my own relationships, and I think about in all my writing, and I think about kind of in these broad ways, because I think that's so pivotal to all of these sorts of relationships. And I mean, Charlie, you know, not spoilers, but, you know, he makes a choice not to tell people something quite pivotal. And her mom and Delia's mother made a choice not to tell her something. The kid's dad made a choice to have an affair, but also makes the choice really not to stick around very much at all, even though he doesn't think that that's something that he's choosing. It really is. And about kind of how choices play into relationships and how much that can kind of manifest in these absences where people don't necessarily want to admit that that's what they're doing, but that's what they are doing, and about what the impact that that has. Again, it kind of comes back to that collateral damage thing. It's about people think they're making choices, they think they're not making choices, but regardless of what they're doing, it has an impact, and it has an impact particularly on children. And even if that child's, you know, like Olive is 19, 20 years old, and to negate that, I think, is detrimental to the way people feel, and to allowing people to feel the way that they feel. And it has those, it's that ripple effect, you know, Rosie not telling Delia about this very important part of her had an impact the way that Delia processed her sister's disappearance, which had an impact when it came to Charlie's disappearance too. So yeah, it's very much about kind of the way choices that we make have impacts, and can often lead to these sorts of absences.
And also, you know, I suppose it's a sideways step, but making choices or you know, pretending that we're not choosing, and then those having ramifications. Mm. Again, it just comes down to this idea, you know, and perhaps it's a particularly Western idea, but this idea that we're individuals and we're islands, and what we do doesn't affect someone else. And if we're not actively choosing something, then the consequences aren't our fault. Whereas I think everything that we do affects other people in a multitude of ways, and that's just really magnified in families. And the way that we behave and think and feel and relate to each other in families is seismic in terms of its consequences and its feelings. And, you know, and I think one thing that really came clear to me on reflection when I finished this book, that so much of it to me was about, you know, loneliness but also vulnerability, you know, and the choices that we make or don't make to connect with other people, and how that making ourselves vulnerable to someone else, you know, baring your throat, it can be one of the most difficult things to do as a human, but it's also one of the most important. And I think in families that's also very true. And sometimes, you know, the people that love us the most, sometimes it can be the hardest people to be vulnerable to. Yeah, I don't know, I kind of went off topic a bit there. but yeah, what you were saying really sort of resonated, I think.
To build off that a bit, like, I think that the character of Letty to me came through, like, her vulnerability was really interestingly portrayed. Can you tell me a bit more about her character?
Oh, I love Letty. I have a similar story to Sophie in the fact that when I started this book, I lost confidence. As I said, I listened to some very smart people, but I didn't listen to myself as much as I should perhaps, and it became a YA novel, and it was quite different, and it was a lot more plot-driven rather than character-driven. And, you know, it was fine, it was good. It was shortlisted for the Text Prize, which was wonderful. And then I didn't win, which was probably the best thing that could have happened. I was very lucky. I had a brief chat with Mandy Brett at Text, and she made the very astute comment that this book wasn't, she could see other fingerprints on it. And she asked me, you know, and I said that that was true. And then she asked me, so what was your idea? What would it be if you didn't do the things that you should and rather did the things that you wanted? And I told her, fully expecting that she'd back away thinking I was a psychopath. and she's like, I would read that. And I was like, oh, my God. So off I went, and I threw the YA novel into the bottom drawer where it will remain forever, and I rewrote it from scratch as a million things. The interesting point that long side road is bringing us to is that in the original story, Letty didn't exist.
Huh.
And when I started rewriting it, Letty also didn't exist. And then I was like, oh, obviously a neighbour's going to notice. So there was Letty. And then she just kept popping up. She was in more scenes. And then suddenly they were going on a road trip. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess you're kind of important then. And I think that's kind of the character of Letty. She deliberately fades into the background and has this persona of someone that at first glance perhaps isn't a large person, and she's massive, and she has a lot of secrets of her own. She's a hoarder, not that you would notice from the front of her house, but certainly the whole street is aware of it. And she has her own, you know, secrets and deep losses in her family as well. And again, I didn't start out planning that. That was kind of that, thank you, subconscious. That really, I didn't think, oh, yes, that would tie in neatly with Ray's situation. It just kind of happened. And thank God it did. In the story, they really help each other from a character perspective, but also in terms of mirroring each other a little bit. And it also allowed me to give greater depth, I suppose, to one of the major themes, which is, I suppose, and not deliberately, but mental health and mental illness. And I didn't want any of that in this book to be, you know, a character quirk or something that made them interesting. It was, I couldn't in good conscience do that. It was something that it needed to be deeper than that, and it wasn't a trick as a writer to make an interesting point. It was about exploring the depth of those illnesses and also the humanity of them. And I really hope that I did that, but certainly, yeah, Letty is a very big character who likes to make herself look small for safety. And I think, you know, that's again making yourself a small target, you know, again, the fear of vulnerability, I think.
I was absolutely not ready to let Letty go when I finished the book. I wanted more of her.
I loved Letty too. And I think it was such an interesting thing with her, which is the way that she really sees Ray and about how much books and stories about absences, I think the ways that you are seen are really important too, and having that kind of relationship and mutual relationship really with Ray and Letty, where they both really saw each other. And in particular, the bit where Ray thinks that Letty's kind of seeing her daughter in her, but it's not. Letty's seeing herself in her was something I just found wonderful and like was really moved by.
Thank you. I think you got that whole seeing thing too very much with Mindy and Olive. Mindy was sort of this character, a little bit like Letty, I suppose, in that way, if we're looking for parallels, in coming across as, you know, oh, yeah, just someone that works at the supermarket, not very important. And she turns pretty special.
Yeah.
I love that relationship. I found that quite beautiful too. And there was that vulnerability there too where Olive is very prickly, you know, very Letty and Ray in that way, I suppose, very, very defensive and not letting anyone into her soft core, who really did open herself up to Mindy in a way that she didn't really to anyone else through most of the story. And I found that quite beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, could you tell us a bit more about Mindy, actually? I was going to ask you to expand.
So. Yeah. I've worked a lot in retail. and I don't know, like I'm always fascinated by the relationships that you have with people in kind of in retail. I had a really interesting quote recently and like well and truly after I finished the book, but it was about whether a friend is for a reason, a season, or a lifetime, which I just thought was like, it's a really, really incredible quote, and about how much that kind of is very much the encapsulation of Olive's relationships in most of the rabbits, and about how kind of you end up with these friends that you don't really expect. And for a lot of the book, Olive doesn't even realize that she's got a friend in Mindy. Mm-hmm. And Mindy's kind of, you know, Mindy's not there pestering. She's not there. She can take or leave the friendship really, but she does like Olive, you know, and she enjoys her company and they get along. And she thinks that, you know, when you're working in retail, you know, that's where you're spending most of your hours of the day. It's you end up kind of having to form these relationships when you're working to kind of survive. And yeah, she kind of came out fully formed. I know a lot of women like her through working in retail. And she was just one of those characters that just, yeah, she walked onto the page and announced herself a bit. And yeah, similarly, she was a much smaller character in earlier drafts, but she kind of grew as the drafts went on, as the story went on. But she was a lot of fun to write. Yeah.
She was a lot of fun to read.
Yeah. And I can still smell that fruit from like when it just.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All the rot. I was the same with the blood and bone in A Million Things. I was like, I know that smell way too well. Yeah.
Burns them off.
Yeah.
So coming towards my last question, to conclude, I just want to ask you both about the ways in which the missing person is present in both your books, because they are, but that you each approach this very differently. So do you want to talk a little bit about that without getting too much into spoiler territory, which might be tricky?
Yeah, so obviously it's Ray's mum. I struggle with this a little bit. When I first started talking about my book, I just talked about what happened because really it's on page three. but then I found that lots of people, like probably 40% of people that read the book, like a Rorschach test, I think, didn't want to see what had happened, and then read the rest of the book going, oh, I think I know, but I'm not really sure, so I'm just going to pretend that horrible thing hasn't happened. And I will respect that readership, and I will try not to spoil it. The missing person that we never see really is Ray's mum, who also doesn't have a name. I mean, she does. I'm not going to tell you what it is. But it's Ray's mum, and we see her as a negative, you know, as a negative space, as a ghost almost, and it's very much, you know, I suppose the aspect of grief where so many things that you do come back to the missing person, to the person that's not there, and it's the everyday things, you know, the cleaning of teeth, the turning out of the light, the eating of dinner, what happens when you enter the house, what happens when you leave the house, all of those things are there as a ghost, I suppose. So I hope that the reader gets a well-rounded picture of Ray's mum. I certainly tried to give one, but I didn't want it to be a picture of, you know, a selfish woman who left her child behind, because that's certainly not the case. She loved Ray really, really deeply, and I worked really hard, and I hope I was successful to get that across. But she wasn't well. And she struggled a lot with that. And she did the absolute best that she could, but it just wasn't enough, because sometimes it isn't. And I didn't want to sugarcoat that. I didn't want this to be, you know, everything gets tied up in a nice, neat little bow and everything's fine in the end, because life isn't like that. And things don't have a neat, happy ending all the time. They have an ending, and sometimes that ending's bearable and it's okay and there's hope for the future, and that's a great thing. But I wanted to show Ray's mum, I wanted to show the happy bits of her and the beautiful bits of her and the love that she gave her daughter. But I also wanted to show the other side of that. So I suppose creating a character in negative space is it ties your hands, but it also frees you a little bit. I think having that real constriction, it opens up, you know, space within it as well. And it allowed me to allow Ray to really have those moments of memory, which started off often quite painful. But as they went, you know, she allowed happier stuff to come in as well. And to understand how we know people, I think, to try and illuminate a little bit. Yes, we're all connected and we're all people, but we're also quite separate in our own ways as well. It's that wonderful push-pull dichotomy, isn't it, where you can, how well can you ever really know someone, but at the same time we're so interconnected. And to show someone in that negative space and to have the realization that when someone is gone, what is left of them is what we have of them in our memories and our thoughts and things like that. So that was the picture that I tried to build of Ray's mum in the absence, was the picture of someone as you remember them when they're gone.
That's really lovely. And I think that came across just, really, really beautifully. And I think that, negative space thing just is really encapsulates it beautifully. For me, one of the things that was really important was exploring the way that when we lose people, they never really leave us, particularly if they were really significant, and ways that over in the immediacy of losing someone, the way that they're still everywhere, you know, especially if you live with them, they're all through your house, they've got their shit everywhere still. And about, you know, you feel them, it's like almost like a phantom limb situation. You know, you just feel them and their presence. But even as the years pass, you move house, you do all of this sort of stuff, you pack all of these memories away, but they're still, as they are in the rabbits, they're right there in the cupboard ready to spill out again as soon as, you know, a kid gets into them, or, you know, or something happens where the memories all of a sudden they're really close to the surface again. And, you know, that's one of the things in particular I tried to capture with Delia. When the first time she really, and only time she really looks for Charlie, she just goes to the creek where they found Beau's body and just waits. And she knows that it's probably not this sort of thing, but that whole, the weight of her sister's disappearance weighs on Charlie's disappearance. You know, it's heavy on that. But yeah, it comes back to that kind of thing about they're just not gone. They don't go, no matter how much you want them to sometimes, of which I think every character in this book would like that to go away. But it manifests as well in different ways throughout it. Most notably, of course, with Rosie towards the end when she has her little reveal as well. But yeah, so I guess that was that's very much about what the absence means for this, is about you might lose someone, but you're never really left behind, I guess, to bring it back to the theme of the panel.
I think that's a great note to end on. So thank you both, Sophie and Emily. The Rabbits and A Million Things are available for purchase through the Melbourne Writers Festival Partner Bookshop Readings. Thank you all for tuning in and for supporting Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.